Welcome to Special Sauce, Serious Eats podcast about food and life. Every week on Special Sauce, we talk to some of the leading lights of American culture, food folks and non-food folks alike.
I have a purpose that is way beyond me. Sometimes it's the purpose of an immigrant. Sometimes it's the purpose of a black man. Sometimes it's a community leader in Harlem, which is very similar to my father's tribe in Africa.
Today, it is my pleasure to have here an old running partner of mine, chef restaurateur, entrepreneur, and author Marcus Samuelson. Born in Ethiopia, Marcus was adopted by a Swedish couple at a very early age. He trained as a chef in Sweden and worked in Swiss and French kitchens before coming to the U.S. as a trainee at Aquavi, the acclaimed contemporary Scandinavian restaurant. There, he rose to become head chef, earned 3 stars from the New York Times, and in time, won the James Beard Award for Best Chef, New York City. Later, in the neighborhood he'd come to call home, he opened a reimagined reincarnation of a classic Harlem watering hole, the Red Rooster, arguably ground zero for the Harlem food and drink renaissance. Marcus has co-written many books, including the acclaimed memoir, Yes, Chef, and the just-published The Red Rooster Cookbook, the story of food and hustle in Harlem. My old friend, Marcus Samuelson, how come in someone who was born in Ethiopia, raised in Sweden, makes the only good Swedish meatballs I've ever had in my life?
I love that. That's a great to start, right? But, you know, I think meatball is one of those dishes that it's more the reminiscence of your grandmother than it is the dish itself, right? It's one of these things that I can't make meatballs without not thinking about Helga. And it's more delicious to me because of her. If you didn't grow up on the culture, yeah, it's our meatballs with lingonberries and some gravy. It's just, you know, it's one of those dishes that can be forever argued.
And was it your grandmother's recipe or something you tinkered with?
Well, it was both. You know, the starting point of my cooking really started around meatballs with her, making meatballs with her, but then also adding liver in or adding other things in that, you know, as a chef that you want to play with, but you realize I've had that taste before because it wasn't always an equal part pork, an equal part veal, an equal part beef around. It was, you have chicken, let's grind it up. Okay, you have some pork in there. Okay, let's throw that in, and that's your meatball.
So now let's really start where the journey began, which is Ethiopia. You write so movingly about your fractured early childhood there. I mean, the first line of your memoir is that you've never seen a picture of your mother. I literally started to cry when I read that. I'm also orphaned.
Yeah.
And you weren't even orphaned, as it turned out. But tell us about your mom's journey in saving your life and not saving hers.
You know, that the women in the villages in Africa and in so many places in the developing world, they're so strong. And they're carrying water, they're carrying kids, they're carrying, you know, dried food. And for not to be able to ever seen my mother is something that picture image is always haunting me when I go back to Africa. Anytime I see a young woman in her early 20s, you know, with 2 kids, I always think about, was that my mother? Is that how she looked like? That she carried us with one arm here and my sister that was
with
born
tuberculosis, with 75 TV. Miles.
Yes. And having dried food, as you know, walking at night because it was cooler, bringing with her, you know, dried food because that was the only thing she could carry. So these amazing stories where I realize I'm part of. But so many of us, not just in Africa, you know, adoption, people are orphaned. It's not just, it doesn't have a nationality. And just like you said, it doesn't say on your forehead that you were orphaned. But I meet so many adult people that said, hey, my brother was adopted. I was adopted. So it does create this sort of like
resonance.
Absolutely.
Yeah, that's fascinating. And at that point, when your mother makes it to the hospital with you and your sister, she doesn't make it out of the hospital.
Yeah.
you at that point had thought your father had died in the war with
Civil War with Eritrea. Yep.
And you had no idea.
We had no idea that he was still alive. And then eventually, it's also so many random things. It's the goodness of others, right? We were healthy at that point. We stayed at the hospital, and the nurse said, where are these kids going to go, this 2-year-old and this 4-year-old? She just said, you know, I'll bring them in. I'll take them in. She was a single mother and nurse, had 4 kids. She said, I'll take the kids in, and until we set them up for adoption, they will stay with me.
Wow.
I mean, that's not just random luck. That's just, sometimes life is like that, right?
Yeah.
You just have to be.
And that was, you were 4?
Yeah, I was 2 and my sister was 4.
So you're a young Ethiopian child.
Yeah.
Who has been adopted by a Swedish couple.
Mm-hmm.
You and your sister, they took you both. I mean, what were you feeling?
Well, the very first thing I remember is that we were banging on the refrigerators because we saw that there were food coming out of the refrigerators.
Wow.
And the doctor was very clear to my mother that we couldn't eat 3 meals a day in the beginning because we weren't used to that. But we as kids just saw that there was food coming out of the refrigerator.
And you'd never seen anything like that.
What is that? So that was like literally my first memory, remembering that. And then also, you know, after that, it could be eating berries.
Mm-hmm.
It could be, you could go outside in Sweden and pick anything, right? Because it's all public land. So I remember as a child with my older sister, like going outside, picking wild strawberries.
You were foraging before anyone knew what foraging was, Marcus.
I mean, this very idea that you would put on social media that you're going foraging actually goes against the idea of foraging. My grandmother was very clear. If you found a good place to pick up chanterelles,
don't share
tell
it.
Nobody. Yeah.
So what kind of racial climate were you confronted by in Sweden?
Yeah. I think that my older sister, she was 6 years older than us, she took a lot of it. And my second, Linda, the second one, took a little bit. And then, you know, when you're the youngest, it doesn't hit you as hard. What did change was when you become a teenager, because then you go from being this like almost like cute little toy, right, growing up in this sort of, you know, homogenous country, to like all of a sudden perceived as dangerous. And that was very foreign to me. I'm 5'4 at this point, right? You know, 90 pounds or whatever, right? Like, I'm not that dangerous.
Right. Like, you could be bullied, dude.
Yeah. So that transformation, that transition was very strange. But that's also when looking to America for icons, comfort, know-how became very important, both for my parents and for us as kids.
And your parents put forward those role models.
Yeah, I mean, music, you know, we listened to a lot of music. My father listened to Miles and Louis Armstrong. My mom listened to Maria McKeeby and Bob Marley. I always say Bob Marley was always my first English teacher.
Wow.
Different accent, but still got the message through.
So do you say Jamon?
Yeah, Jamon, you know.
Okay.
But also, as you become older, getting the books of Alex Haley and Malcolm in front of you, reading James Baldwin, getting my dad, you know, how does this, you know, white fisherman's son teach this teenage black kid how to confront racism? Like my father, you know, he became a geologist and very educated, but also through that transition, he's still a fisherman's son. You know, he didn't go to race school, so to speak. Do you know what I mean?
Wow.
So he was not always perfect in this, and it was clumsy, but we had to learn. I remember anytime, for my mom, it was anytime somebody went to London, they had to buy old Essence magazines because it was hairstyles that my mom could mimic for the girls.
Wow. Amazing. So you got interested in food because your grandmother, you say that your adopted mom, and in Sweden didn't really care about cooking.
No.
You decide
sweetheart of a lady.
Yeah.
But
yeah, I understand. The same with my mother. My mother thought it was, you know, like a betrayal of women if she admitted that she liked to cook.
And I always said to mom, like, I know you can buy canned peas, but we're growing peas. Once I started understanding it. And my mother was always like, no, the peas and the peaches that are in cans are better than the fresh ones.
Right.
Because that's the era she came up under, right? These big ads for for preserved food.
Sure. So. You end up going to cooking school.
Yeah.
And there's this wonderful moment in your memoir where you talk about throwing up before service every time. And, you know, I've heard that if you read any actor's memoir, you invariably get to that page where that before they go on, especially, obviously, much more in theater, live, but restaurants are live theater.
Yeah,
let's face
it.
So, but you talk about that, and how long did that last, and how did that come about, and did you try to hide it, and what do you do?
You know, I tried to hide it, but you can't, right? There was really the highest levels of kitchen. I was 18 years old, 18 to 20. I had to speak either German or French. You know, I definitely didn't have any parents around, right? You were basically owned by the hotel or the restaurant you work with, right? And in Switzerland, they could speak Italian, French, or German, and they switched anytime. So you were constantly in an uncomfort zone, right? You were out of your comfort zone. But I learned a lot. I learned a ton, not just about cooking, but how to take care of myself. I had it down to science, taking off my apron, running to the bathroom, throwing up, cleaning myself up, putting that apron back on,
so
being back
on the
line.
That was just part of your routine.
It became part of your routine. And I just think that a lot of people will remember those years as harsh. I also remember them as very loving. You know, the kinship we had as commis, the young guys, which one would get fired. We knew at any given time one of us would get fired, but we wouldn't give up on our dream, right? The stewardship and the mentorship from that one sous chef that actually didn't just try to nail you because he could, but actually trying to teach you a lesson. You never forgot. That guy. He was always your guy. So, yes, it was harsh. Yes, we got food thrown in our face. We got yelled at. We got screamed at. But it was also, you know what? It was my school of learning of life and cooking at the same time.
And you're right. No matter what you do, you end up finding that person that really wants to pay it forward.
Oh. And part of the reason why I wrote both Yes Chef and Red Rooster Cookbook is to show people that no one does it alone. I have a whole tribe that goes between Africa, Scandinavia, Switzerland, France, Japan, Austria, and it's a very imperfect journey. But without that tribe, I wouldn't sit here without you.
So give us an example of, like, someone who really did help you pay it forward.
Oh, there was this gentleman that, Tony Boman, that he always saw me in Sweden. He said, you know what, I'm going to fire you in 18 months. And I was like, you know, I was a kid. I was nervous. What do you mean you're going to fire me? And to the date of 18 months later, he set me up to go to Switzerland for the first, you know, for the first time. And my dad and I, when we got this internship, my dad was like, I don't know about cooking, but I know Switzerland is an organized place. You're going to be like, this is a good thing for you.
The trains run on time in Switzerland.
Exactly. Exactly. So that was a gentleman that always been in my corner. I could never pay them back enough. But the only thing that I wanted back, don't embarrass me and make sure that my line of sending young kids is ruined, right? So you didn't represent yourself. You represented your mentor. And don't you dare come back with something that that my line is credit is no more good.
And just because they were paying it forward and did take an interest in you doesn't mean that they always treated you with kid gloves. did you have to duck any ducks? Like, did people throw ducks at you?
Everything. Ducks, old fish balls, liver. Like, in France, it was Tibet. They had it down to science. You know, summertime, they let those fish liver hang outside. And when we commies came in, they could mash them up with the ice. So your orange juice in the morning could be like old fish liver with mixed in with orange juice. And if you couldn't smell that, detect that because you've been out drinking, oh, you got it all down.
Oh,
but it's
man.
Also fun. I mean, I know it's bad, but it's also how we
came up. Also, you're young.
Yeah.
Exactly. So you're malleable and you're also really, really, you're resilient.
And also, trust me, when that kids, those kids, have you been there for 6 months and there was a new group of kids coming? Oh. We did the same thing back.
Right.
You know?
Sure. So you're getting your chef's training in Switzerland and all over. You're leading the chef, the young single chef's life.
Yeah.
And you write so movingly in the book about having a child.
Yeah.
And that you didn't end up seeing and for a long time. And did that haunt you? I mean,
it haunted me because my mom was the one like, this is not happening under our watch. We're taking care of her. You are not taking care of your responsibilities. I was just a scared 20-year-old kid that thought my goal and dream of becoming a chef would be taken away from me. And my mom said, you can have both, but you have to take care of your responsibility. And so my mom and my sisters very much was part of not only helping being there for my daughter, but also making sure that I did my part. And I think I was just a scared young kid that thought that, hey, one night could change everything, right? And I'm so grateful for that my mother and my sisters were there for me at that time. I have an amazing relationship with my daughter today. And
which was not easy to get to, I assume.
Absolutely not. But I do think that having that moral compass with my parents helped me get there much better, right?
Yeah.
And also, I wanted to be open in the book that you can be very good at one thing and yet live a very imperfect life.
Yes,
and being, sharing that.
And being very good and being focused can eclipse other aspects of feeling and living and doing.
Absolutely. I mean, I never thought I was fully living. I always did compromise around cooking. I never compromised cooking, but all my relationships in life.
Here's a question I've always wanted to ask you, which is, you'd never even seen a picture of your mother.
Mm.
You obviously grew to know and love your adopted parents in Sweden. You met your father very late.
Yeah.
Where does the ambition and focus come from? Is it genetic, or do you think it's a combination of nature and nurture?
I think it's a combination of – that's a great question. I think when I met my birth father, it was great for me to see that he is a tribe leader in Ethiopia. So I see the get-up. I see the hustle. He's really improved his tribe's living in his 80-plus years, right? I made sure there is a road there, make sure there's access to water, like goals for them that are game-changing. So I see that work ethic. But also watching my Swedish father coming from being a fisherman's son to owning his company and being a geologist in the city, that journey. Now, he started very poor and, you know, ended up in an upper-middle-class Swedish lifestyle. That we
Interesting.
Can. But watching that journey, he's still, if you would ask him, he's a fisherman's son. That's who he is.
Right.
But the world, he got a bite of the world.
Interesting.
Right? He spoke English. He spoke
French.
So
it really comes from both of
them. It comes from both of those.
And I would have to say, I would have to add, your mother sounds like she was a pretty extraordinary and strong and focused woman in her own right. She was focused on your survival.
Yes, and whipping me sometimes when I needed to. But I also think, which is really important here, I think also the blessings of being a black man. Because as you and I have known, see the industry, and it's getting better in diversity, but that also gives you clarity. What's my purpose? What am I here for, right? When it's beyond filling seats in a restaurant, you realize that it's not, if we don't do this now, there's not a lot of people looking like me doing what we're doing. So I have a purpose that is way beyond me. Sometimes it's the purpose of an immigrant. Sometimes it's the purpose of a black man. Sometimes it's a community leader in Harlem, which is very similar to my father's tribe in Africa. So I think the blessings of being going from it being an obstacle, always an obstacle, and not getting the job because you were black versus the opportunity.
Interesting.
And not seeing it as an obstacle, but actually celebrating it and owning up to it. And, you know, I can go in a lot of elevators from the dishwasher all the way up to, you know, very, very high boardrooms. And that's a luxury that is not given to a lot of people. So you better take care of that opportunity.
Yeah. So you write in the book that, you know, you ended up cooking at Aquavit for a very short time, then going back to France, working under Georges Blanc, and then coming back to America by writing. Did you really write letters to David Letterman, Oprah Winfrey, and the Aquavit founder?
Yeah, absolutely. I did 3 letters and had, you know what, to get 1 out of 3, 33%, that's not bad.
But it wasn't Oprah or David Letterman.
No, it wasn't. But also back then, you think about it, there's no internet. You're sitting in a bad scenario where you kind of have to wait for, you know, David Letterman's show. You got to get that address down. There's no internet. And Oprah's the same thing, right?
Right. So you write to Harpo Productions.
Harpo Productions in Chicago, getting the full address. And just part of the getting the letter was part of the journey. I remember that day when I dumped those letters in, I'm on my way to America. Now, I believed the way immigrants, when they left Sweden in the 1840s, believed, we're going to America. And that's the beacon of hope. This moment of when diversity gets challenged and who we are gets challenged, it's so personal to me because I bettered everything on that.
So what did you say in the letters to David Letterman? They couldn't give you, and Oprah Winfrey, they couldn't give you jobs as chefs. You just like, I'm a smart dude. Yeah. I'm coming to America.
I will open a restaurant with you. Bet on me, and I will open a restaurant for you. And it's that level of hope / chance /
naivete.
Yeah, and it's also like the biggest Hail Marys of ever, right?
But look, it was answered with Hakan Swan, yes, who owned Aquavit. You became the chef at Aquavit.
Yeah.
You got 3 stars for the New York Times. You won the James Beard Award for Best Chef in New York. And then even that, there was a turn because when you wanted to leave Aquavit, they said, oh, by the way, we own your name.
So one thing that cooking has taught me is that, and you've actually been done this better than the best of them, our industry has changed so many times. So what you walked in as the goal of having that white large hat on and just fit in a kitchen versus what cooking is today, it's still the core is pleasing people and making great food. But owning rights to a name, IP.
You're right.
All of these things, shooting something on Instagram versus Snapchat versus Twitter. All of these things are obviously things that we had no clue about when we started this game. They just came along somewhere midway. And you said one time when you stopped writing for the Times and started that little thing called that website. And by the way, that little thing became the big thing. You said that at a speech, and I thought it was a very, very
thank you
good thing to say. Because who are we to say that thing, right? And well, my point is, I could never imagine how many turns and how many things cooking has changed to. So I didn't even know what to protect. I didn't know if this water bottle was more worth than my name, right?
Wow.
Lawyer up and all that stuff was not even terms. Lawyer was these guys in suits that I cooked for.
So you bought back the rights to Marcus Samuelson.
I did.
You know, if it was early enough, you could have had a Kickstarter drive. Help Marcus Samuelson own his name.
Yes. But, you know, it was very often I thought about, forget it. Maybe I should just go back to my birth name, Casahun Segai.
Wow.
So I was torn with that many, many times. I was like, you know what? And on a Monday, it could be this, and on Tuesday, it could be that.
You're at the top of the fine dining world.
Yeah.
Right? James Beard Award winner, 3 stars from the New York Times, Aquavits in different cities.
Yeah.
And you get back, you have to, you talk about actually emptying your bank account to get your name back.
Yeah.
Which is an insane notion by itself.
It is.
But then what you did was another dramatic turn, which is you decided to open what you call a watering hole in Harlem, the Red Rooster. Marcus, I know you got to run, so we're going to pick this up next week because I have so many more questions for you. We'll have
yes,
you back.
Yes, we'll do it.
But thank you so much for sharing your
thank
special
you
sauce.
Thank you so much for having me, and congratulations to everything you do.
Oh,
Ed.
Please, fantastic. Please. And yeah. If you're ever in New York, you have to check out the Red Rooster in Harlem. It's awesome, and by all means, read Marcus's terrific memoir, Yes, Chef, and pick up a copy of the newly released Red Rooster Cookbook, which is so much more than a cookbook. So long, serious eaters. We'll see you next time.